3:35, March 5th, 2012. Members present, Senator to my right, Co-Chair Pastman, Senator Wilkowski, Senator French, and to my left, Senator Stevens, and I am Senator Wagoner, Co-Chair. We have two bills in front of us today. They're House Bill 185, Senate Bill 153. First, we're going to take up House Bill 185, which is titled Exempt Discharges from Use of Munitions. This bill has been heard twice by the committee, once last year and then the last time on February 21st. We have a previous motion on the bill, which is still in effect. And we've had public testimony and closed public testimony on the bill, so the bill is now in front of the committee to have a discussion or have additional presentations for questions by the committee. So, Ms. Wilson, would you like to lead us into this discussion?
I would, Mr. Chair.
And tell us who you have both online. I guess I can do that. Online is Kevin Ward from Denver, representing the U.S. Army, and also Seth Bosang from Anchorage, Department of Environmental Conservation. You have, I believe, two people here.
Yeah, we have the DMVA, and we also have the attorney who helped us draft the bill.
Okay. So would you like to introduce whoever you would like to start?
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just take the first stab at one more time, a third time, that maybe that I finally have simplified it to where we're all happy.
All right.
For the record, my name is Tammy Wilson. I'm Representative District 11, North Pole. A problem was created when the Alaska Clean Water Act was amended in 2008 to its current form. The state's longstanding comprehensive military munitions exemption, AS Section 46.03.100E7, the current language, unless it results in a discharge into waters of the United States, potentially allows for a more expansive, unintended application of the Alaska Clean Water Act than the Federal Clean Water Act, due to the many and varying interpretations of waters of the U.S. The proposed amendment in 185, unless otherwise regulated by the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, will maintain the state's primacy and, at the same time, allow Alaska military ranges to comply with state law by operating in accordance with federal law. If not passed, there exists the possibility that military ranges would need to curtail operations because of unique interpretations of Alaska law, even if the ranges are in compliance with federal law. As a consequence of the potential limited uses of the military ranges, the Department of Defense could decide to use this decision to downsize our military presence in Alaska. And so, the bottom line is, with 185, we maintain primacy, protect the environment, and allow military exercises to continue without potential legal issues. I took on this bill for the military because, as you know, ILSN is one of those that could have a potential loss. And I can't understand why we would do anything at this point to give the federal government any reason to move out of Alaska. And with that, that's my statements. And, Mr. Chair, based on the questions, I would think we would want to invite up whomever you need. Thank you so much for the time.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions? I see.
Well, I want to have a question of the attorney.
Bring the attorney up, please. When you come up, please put yourself on the record. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Through the chair, my name is Alpheus Fullard, and I'm a lawyer with Ledge Legal, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Pastman.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Wagner. You know, when we were hearing this a year ago, one of your responses indicated that the effects and purpose of the legislation weren't clear. And so what I guess the question is whether they, you know, what your current thoughts are.
Through the chair, members of the committee, In terms of the purpose and the effects of the legislation, I think that the sponsor of the legislation has spoken to that. In terms of how things are currently enforced, I don't know if there's a distinction with a difference to talk about into the waters of the United States or to talk about what's regulated underneath the Clean Water Act. At this moment, there is no difference. Perhaps later on, if the state were to more stringently define waters of the United States, which is without definition in our statutes, it's possible that there might be some deviation, and that's what the requester has spoken to.
Senator Passman.
You know, the issue of primacy, as I understand, is establishing the ADEC as a procedural agency to handle permitting. I guess, is that the first step? Is that accurate?
With regard to permitting, forgive me, I'm not sure I entirely understand your question.
All right. Well, ultimately, is, as I read this, ADEC would procedurally handle the issuance of any permit if it were to be needed, but it would be issued, if this became law, with federal law being the only substantive law applying.
Through the chair, that's my understanding as well. I'm not sure what situation would exist where in our permitting process under having adopt primacy over that responsibility, where the state would regulate federal waters differently than what federal law allowed for underneath the Clean Water Act.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've gone around and around and around on this bill, but is the essence of this bill that we are, our current law says, we're exempt. Essentially, our current law says that firing or other use of munitions and training activities is allowed unless it results in discharge into waters of the United States. And what we're doing by changing this law is changing that to waters regulated under 33 U.S.C. 1251 to 1376. I mean, is that the essence of the bill?
That is the essence of the bill. There is one other change, which includes the word service. But since that's just an including provision, it doesn't really expand it. So the substance of the bill is the line you've described.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could. So by passing this law, we are turning over our sovereignty and allowing the federal government to decide what the definition is under 33 U.S.C. 1251. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, I'm not sure that's entirely fair to say. I don't think that the state has, well, in this particular realm, that much to say about federals of the waters of the United States. The state may have a great deal to say about the waters of the state, but whether we talk about waters of the United States or the Clean Water Act.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, but right now what we're saying is we have a law in the books that you can't shoot munitions into if it results in discharge in the waters of the United States, and we're changing that to give a control over what happens on our military base regarding munitions to the federal government. In other words, the federal government can change the law in a way that maybe we like or in a way that maybe we really don't like, and by passing this legislation, we are losing our ability, our authority in that regard. Is that an accurate assessment?
Through the chair, sovereignty is a big word. There is some latitude that's lost. I don't know how much latitude is lost or how much will be. I would say I believe that language as it reads now, waters of the United States, was originally selected when this section was drafted to comply with the Clean Water Act. And so the change that the legislation sponsor is requesting is in a similar vein to keep this section consistent with the Clean Water Act. Not that I can speak to all the motivations of the requester, but I don't think this has so much to do with Civinity as continuing to parallel the Clean Water Act, or to make it more exacting to that point.
Senator Pastan.
Again, that's kind of getting to the point. Let's assume that the federal government standards stayed the same, and Alaska, with respect to discharges into its waters eventually, would, if Alaska wanted to have a say, does this bill authorize that or not authorize that?
Through the chair, it's possible that sometime in the future that it might be possible for the state to more strictly construe waters of the United States than those waters that are regulated beneath the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. But what happens in federal waters is eventually the say of the federal government. So I don't know how much Civinity might be lost.
Senator Pastan.
You know, to some extent, those whole issues of what are federal waters as compared to what are state waters, and, you know, we've had a big dust-up in interior Alaska this last year, but ultimately the question of can Alaska have a substantive say if, as I understand, this law would say that the federal law is the only substantive law that would be considered under any permitting process. So if the federal law is the only substantive law, then that seems to eliminate Alaska's voice if we had a specific concern as to discharges into the waters in Alaska.
Through the chair, I recognize your concern, and I think that it's a legitimate concern. Without understanding what the changes might be in the future as regards state or federal law, it's very difficult for me to speak to. It's an enormously complex area, and I don't know in a particular factual situation how that might play out or what would be lost. It's really not clear to me.
But let's put a but in there. But without this law passing, we could jeopardize at least two bases in the state of Alaska due to the lack of their ability to operate on their firing ranges. Is that the essence of what I see with this bill? And the federal government is trying to help us out with that, as far as I can see it.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, you're speaking to policy considerations, and I don't know what the considerations of the military or the federal government are. I think that if they have the specific law cited, that they're provided certainty as to how this is going to be enforced. And without our own definition of waters of the United States, they lack that certainty, I think, is what you might hear from other people who would speak to the bill. How that relates to Civinity is another issue.
Let's hear from the military side of this issue.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chairman, McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner, DMVA, and Kevin Ward is on with the Department of Army as well to answer any additional questions. But the fact of the matter is that everyone's at risk right now. We know this. It's no secret. And we as a state are competing with other states to make sure that we're in an environment that is the easiest to do business. Now, that means we need to be responsible, obviously, as residents of our state. And we need to put in the provisions that make sure that we are the best place to do business for the military. This is one of those areas where the military has come to us and said, we think this is something that could be a hindrance, and we would like to help you guys clean it up so it still mirrors what you want to do as a state, and it mirrors our needs under the Federal Clean Water Act. That way it's very clear and concise, and we understand where we're at. Now, certainly, if there's any question about what can or cannot be done in the future, instead of operating in a gray area, DOD will operate where it knows it can take care of business. And that's the fact of the matter, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Pastor.
Are there other states that their departments of environmental conservation maintain more than just a procedural role? In other words, do other states have their substantive state law operate with the substantive federal law?
Through the chair, Mr. Senator Pascavan, I can't speak to other states' environmental conservation departments, but I can tell you that every other state has this exemption very clearly defined for military firing ranges. We are the only state that does not, and we did have it defined until we accidentally changed it and didn't incorporate this original basis into it. That's the entire reason for this discussion.
Any additional questions?
Well, maybe it's ADEC, because as I understand that they were going to take over primacy last fall, and then they haven't. And so I was going to ask them.
Okay. We have thanks. We have Seth Bosang online in Anchorage.
Yes. Through the chair, I believe the question was about DEC assuming primacy over these kinds of permits. And my understanding is that that is a multi-stage process, and that we are we're not all the way through all the stages, but we are in the process.
Okay. Senator Passman.
And possibly, do you know if other states maintain a say in their substantive laws to the state's Clean Water Act in similar situations?
Through the chair, I do not know that. That is something I could go back and research and provide that to the committee if that's desired, but I do not know the status of other states who have sought primacy, how they have dealt with this issue.
Senator Pastan.
And then lastly, how many states have sought primacy under these circumstances where the state DEC is applying substantive federal law?
Through the chair, again, Seth Bosang, I don't know the answer to that question, but I would be happy to provide that to the committee if that's desired, to the extent I can determine the answer.
Does this go to finance next? This is it. This is the last one. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Kevin Ward might have the answer. I mean, he's been dealing with this longer than he's online.
Kevin Ward's with the U.S. Army. Kevin, are you there in Denver? Can you hear us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you follow the discussion that's taken place?
Yes, I have.
Can you answer those questions?
Not entirely, but I can tell you what I do know.
All right.
I believe in the United States, approximately 45 states, give or take, have primacy for their Clean Water Act programs. I believe that those states, in part, rely upon the substantive requirements of the Federal Clean Water Act in establishing their state law requirements. In the Alaska situation, even with the change proposed, the state and ADEC would be in a position not just to implement procedural requirements, but also to implement state substantive requirements as it would pertain, for example, to classifying the state waters, what types of discharges would be allowed to waters in the state, pollutants, discharge limitations, etc. As the other speakers have stated, this amendment primarily, in fact, exclusively addresses the issue of what waters would be covered. And to that to answer that question, there would be reference to the Federal Clean Water Act. But otherwise, it is the state procedural and substantive requirements that would apply.
Okay. For the record, please state, I know you have in the past, state your title, please.
Yes, I apologize, Mr. Chair. I am Kevin Ward. I am regional counsel for the Army's Regional Environmental Office in Denver, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Department of Defense Regional Environmental Coordinator.
Thank you, Kevin. I'd just like the record to know we've been joined by Senator Thomas, and we've been Kathy Geisel, Senator Geisel, has been with us from the start, and also Senator Egan. So, welcome to the committee. So, are there additional questions of Mr. Ward? Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, I just want to make sure if we don't pass this piece of legislation, the note that I have here says essentially this doesn't change anything. There may be a change in the future by the federal government, but if we don't pass this piece of legislation today, right now, essentially nothing changes. Is that fair?
Through the chair, Kevin Ward speaking again. The Alaska DEC program is being implemented through a number of stages. The stage that would apply to military munitions or military ranges, according to the current schedule, will not be implemented until October of this year, 2012. So if something is not enacted today, since, as I understand it, US EPA remains the authority, nothing would change. But after October 2012, it is possible that this would have an effect, depending upon how discharges into waters of the United States is interpreted. If it is interpreted in a way that is unique to Alaska, as opposed to the requirements of the Federal Clean Water Act, that could have a negative effect on military operations.
This is Senator Wagoner. I'd like to ask you another question. And I'm one of the lucky guys because my economy in my district is not dependent upon military or having a military base there. But if there are base closures coming down the pike, how much would a situation like this weigh in on whether to keep a base open or move a base or close a base down? Would it be a weighing factor at all, or would it be a insignificant factor?
Mr. Chair, I am not privy to the Department of Defense discussions, plans, et cetera, regarding any additional rounds of base closures. But I can tell you from the last round of base closures in about 2005, there were a number of criteria that were used to evaluate bases and installations throughout the United States. And one of those criteria was military value. And in evaluating military value of any particular base or installation, factors that were looked at included an installation's ability to absorb current and future mission requirements, whether the condition, availability, and condition of land facilities and airspace, including training areas, were suitable for training and staging, whether the military installation or base had the ability to accommodate currently unforeseen contingencies, et cetera. So the military value of an installation was examined, was looked at as a factor in determining the conclusions reached by that BRAC commission.
Thank you. Are there further questions by the committee? Senator Wilikowski. Yeah.
And I guess more of a comment than a question, but I'm just trying to balance in my mind. We have a law in the books right now. It says you can't fire munitions unless, or essentially it controls firing of munitions into discharge in the waters of the United States. I know my district backs up to a military base, and there have been firings into waters and wetlands which have had environmental impacts. And so I'm weighing that on the one hand, but on the other hand, of course, don't want to jeopardize our bases. And so I guess it's more of a comment than a question of where I'm at on this. I'm not really sure how I can resolve that in my mind. I'm concerned about turning our Alaska law on this issue over what it seems to me to be the federal government, turning our right to control where munitions are fired and having impacts in the waters of the United States over to the federal government, which may completely exempt that, may say it's okay to do that. So that's sort of where my head is at on this issue, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to balance the two in a way that protects my constituents, protects the people in my district, but also doesn't compromise the bases. And I just haven't come to a complete resolution in my head.
Senator Pat, man?
You know, I understand what the intent here is, and certainly I don't think anyone up here wants to say that, you know, Alaska is not military friendly, but then at the same time, Alaska's sovereignty interests and its rights to say, you know, maybe one size doesn't fit all, that Alaska has a substantive voice in it. And so what I've heard to some extent is that this law would only be necessary if Alaska's DEC were to interpret the law different than, as I understand, they currently interpret it. And so if that doesn't happen in October of 2012, then this law isn't needed. That's kind of what I heard.
Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Passman. You know, laws are only as good until they get sued. Somebody gets sued, and you know that. And that's really the purpose of this whole thing. Do we want to wait and see what happens in October? And possibly this doesn't go through now. We wait, and something does happen. You know, in March, they're going to be up at Eielson. They're going to be looking at all these things, the money, all the different bills that we pass that are also going to help us. You know, the basic question is, do we want this to be one of those black marks that go on? And do you think they're responsible? The military bases don't have to be here. The training ranges don't have to be here. They're here, and we get the benefit of the economy that comes with that and the support of our military being here. And so for me, it is, yes, you're absolutely right. We don't have to do anything with this bill. We could just set it aside and wait and see what happens and wait till the first group gets sued. Or we could be proactive instead of reactive and pass this knowing that DEC, EPA, and the military here all got together to craft this very specifically so it didn't have unintended consequences, and that's why we're here. So personally, I'd rather be proactive. They, you know, unlike some others, you know, the military is huge in my area, and I personally don't want to do anything to jeopardize that, but I also would not put this forward if I thought it jeopardized anything with the Clean Water Act as well or did anything to do with pollution, because we are good about taking care of our land here. But to me, this is a military action. This would not have been put together by those EPA, DEC, if they thought at all this would have a negative effect on our environment. But I do appreciate where you're coming from. But I do believe that we are the last ones to take this kind of action for a reason. Thank you.
Representative Wilson, I'd like to bring the commissioner up again, deputy commissioner up. I have one more question for him.
Mr. Chairman?
Was it not one of the specific reasons the Stryker Brigade was moved here is because of the ability to train over other areas in the United States? Was that not one of the primary considerations for moving the Stryker Brigade to Alaska?
For the record, McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner, DMVA. Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. And we have the the benefit of having two brigade combat teams in Alaska right now. We have one at Jay Bear and one at Fort Wainwright. That's about 3,500 to 4,000 troops in each, totaling between 7,000 and 8,000 folks, active duty soldiers and their families. I just went to a defense communities conference last week. Communities are clamoring to identify first and foremost what cuts are going to take place before a BRAC discussion even happens. And one of the announcements that DOD made was the Army is going to cut two of the eight brigade combat teams. Now, what does that mean? There's a lot of wiggle room there. We have two of those eight here in Alaska right now. There could be some discussion of cutting two and merging the one that we have and losing some soldiers. But the primary reason Alaska is a good place for the Army to be is because we have the open access to training. Obviously, in Senator Wilikowski's district, there's a large section of training on the mountainside. But more importantly, up in the interior, near Senator Pascavan, there's the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, which the legislature just invested close to $80 million, a little more than $80 million, to build a bridge across there for access for those Stryker vehicles. So it's important that obviously we're responsible in our development, but we also give a clear and direct path forward on how that area can be used.
Thank you. Senator Pascavan?
What I would like to know, and I understand the federal DEC is supportive of this, you know, but the question is that I would like the Alaska DEC to explicitly respond to is, are they okay with giving up Alaska's DEC's future involvement in clean water?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, it wouldn't be proposed here if they weren't. This is something that's been supported.
I'd like to hear that explicitly from the administration. In other words, not from Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation, that they want, that they're willing to give up that right. Isn't there someone from ADEC online?
Yeah, we've heard from him. Seth Bosang, would you answer the question of Senator Pascavan, please?
Through the chair, I'd be happy to. Again, my name is Seth Bosang. I'm an assistant attorney general. I'm representing DEC today. I would hesitate a little bit to, because I'm primarily here to answer legal questions, to answer the question directly, but I do note that there is a letter that was submitted to the committee, I believe, in the last session, which makes it quite clear that DEC does support this change. It outlines some of the reasons. I mean, the general reason is to an effort to promote consistency between state requirements and federal requirements. And I would also say that I don't think it's accurate to say that DEC is giving up its role in Clean Water Act permits or even permits that might be required for munitions discharges. They're going to still have a role to the extent permits are required. They would be the issuing body, and state standards would apply. The only thing this act is trying to do is make it consistent between state and federal law when those permits would be required. I hope that answers the chair's question.
Additional questions? Is there any additional questions, comments?
Senator
McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say I support the bill, and I support the department. I understand the concerns that have been expressed here. I think it's easy to let yourself go down rabbit trails and worry about the things that could happen, but I think the evidence shows that every other state has it, and Alaska did have it up until 2008, and I'm not aware of any catastrophic incidents. I think that there's a natural balance always between the federal government and the state government's, you know, rights with respect to primacy, and I think it's difficult. But I don't want to do anything at this stage that would render Alaska less competitive when we're in BRAC closures. And I know from Mark Begich's speech today and Lisa's last week that, you know, the defense spending has gone way down, and it's not a given that Alaska gets the support it's had in past years for our bases. So I support it wholeheartedly. You can count me as a yes vote as you're looking for votes here. And I think we ought to move it forward and know that, you know, the department is made up of Alaskans that live here too with their children and certainly aren't going to be doing anything that would jeopardize the health of our citizens. That's how I feel.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, I mean, my concern is, and maybe if someone online can just correct me if I'm wrong, or someone in the room can correct me if I'm wrong, but under the current law, we have a provision that basically says you can't fire munitions if it results in a discharge into waters of the United States. What we would be doing is, and I'm still, I guess, a little bit confused, we would be saying you can't fire munitions in a training area unless it's otherwise regulated under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. And so by passing this, we would be changing state law where we take direct charge of what we're allowing and disallowing and saying we're giving that control to the federal government, who could then go ahead and either pass or not pass, make a change to the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. I mean, can someone just clarify whether that is a correct understanding?
Through the chair, once again, Alpheus Fuller of Ledge Legal. Right now, what we have under the law is an exemption for munitions fired from active ranges that go into the waters of the United States. Under the change contemplated by House Bill 185, what we would have an exemption for munition unless those munitions that went into the waters of the United States were otherwise regulated by the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, which right now is the case in terms of how the statute would be interpreted under waters of the United States. It's possible in the future, in some theoretical future, that underneath this statute that waters of the United States could be defined differently so that those two were not aligned.
But what you're saying right now, they are aligned.
Right now, they are aligned.
And with the passage of this bill, they will remain aligned.
They would remain aligned.
Okay. That's good enough for me. I think we've beat this dead horse enough. Any other questions come before the committee? We have House Bill 185 in front of us. What's the pleasure of the committee?
I'd like to make a motion that we
Senator
move.
McGuire.
Okay. I move that we move CS for House Bill number 185 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes out of this committee.
Is there any objection?
I'll just speak. Yeah, I was contemplating objecting to this, Mr. Chairman, but I think I understand the bill a little bit better today. I appreciate the comments, the attorney being here. It's clarified in my mind a little bit what's going on. I think by passing this, we're putting ourselves in alignment with the federal government. I'm okay with that, and so I'm not going to object to moving this bill at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other discussion? The motion? Seeing none, the bill will move to, I think we go to rules. And with that, I'll call.
That's got to be good.
We'll bring the Senate Resources Committee back to order. We first heard Senate Bill 153 relating to natural gas storage tax credit and regulation on February 9th, 2012, so approximately 1 month ago. And during that hearing, Senator Thomas presented the merits of the bill, and also there was much supportive testimony was provided as well, including Mr. Newton, CEO of Golden Valley Electric, Mayor of the Fairbank North Star Borough, Luke Hopkins, Mayor of the City of North Pole, Doug Isaacson, Jim Dotson, CEO of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, and Dan Britton, CEO of Fairbanks Natural Gas. On February 9th, the bill was heard and held, and then it was set aside for additional work. And as I understand, we now have a new CS before the committee. And so may I please have a motion to bring the committee substitute for Senate Bill 153, Version D, before the committee.
I would move CS for Senate Bill number 153 / D.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Thomas and Mr. Hopkins, please. And I think it is appropriate to indicate it's my intent to hear from Senator Thomas, to have him explain the changes to the bill, and then we'll set it aside, and that the next hearing of this will open the public testimony, and if it's the will, move it to the next committee or referral. So we're here today to get the changes. And so, Senator, please proceed.
Boy, two microphones. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a short refresher on the bill. Of course, as you heard it before, we know that the price of fuel oil, particularly in the interior and through much of the Northwest and the western part of the state and the Northeast, is crippling the economies. Extremely difficult operations. In the interior, more specifically Fairbanks, at $4 a gallon for heating fuel, Fairbanks spending $667 million annually on energy costs alone. This averages out to about $6,667 for every man, woman, and child in the interior. Much of this money is simply leaving the community and not circulating in local state economy. So Fairbanks currently pays $23.35 for 1,000 cubic feet of gas, 23 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity. And as I said, the price of a gallon of fuel has been hovering around $4. Individual heating bills of $1,000 to $1,500 a month for the heating season, which is basically September through April, depending on the winter season, depending on the year. And this year was a pretty severe year, most of it. So that's about a $6,000 to $8,000 that is being expended simply on heating your home. Many Alaskans take advantage of the weatherization and the energy efficiency programs, but these increased costs have eaten up much of the savings. And as the price of oil goes up, it's great for the state of Alaska as far as revenue, but it's just crippling the individuals in their households. Natural gas is our lowest cost fuel, but it's three times the price as it is in South Central, and only available to 1,100 customers in Fairbanks, because Fairbanks Natural Gas, the distributor, is limited by what they can get. If the winter is cold in South Central as well, FNG is the first one to be limited on the amount of gas that they can purchase and resell. And recently we had where the hospital as well as some other primary facilities were cut off. And they cut off those, of course, at first that have auxiliary power that they can rely on. So although it's somewhat of an emergency, it's not an emergency in that fashion. But as the price of oil continues to go up, it makes it even more. And as the winters maybe colder, that does have an extreme effect on it. We have distribution lines that have already been built out in Fairbanks but not connected up because of that limitation that Fairbanks Natural Gas has. And if they were able to access more gas, it would be a different situation. That's why the trucking project has come to light. I've been working on that for two or three years now, and this project and this concept with Senate Bill 153 begins to address that problem by incentivizing the private sector to deliver additional trucked and natural gas to Fairbanks over the next couple, 3 years. SB 153 would extend the $15 million of tax credits to a liquid natural gas trucking project, such as the one proposed by Golden Valley Electric and Flint Hills, and FNG is also involved in that project. They're having more discussions now as far as how they move forward together on that. This is basically an equivalent of the $15 million in tax credits that currently is applicable to Cook Inlet's gas storage project, CINGSA. We are simply looking to receive that same benefit in Fairbanks for above-ground storage. We don't have the opportunity to store gas underground in Fairbanks. The gas trucking proposals are not new, and we are cautiously optimistic that they will be moving forward. They both evaluated the process. They did work some with ADA, and ADA gave them a stamp of approval, so to speak, that it did the project did pencil out, and they thought it was a good project and were actually willing to participate in it, and that's still being discussed these days. Cost savings from SB 153's $15 million or 50% of construction costs, whichever is less, will play a substantial role in ensuring that this project moves forward by cutting some of the total costs that will have to be amortized by Golden Valley ratepayers. And obviously the costs here are passed through because it is a regulated utility. And that's what we're looking to do, is drive that price down in the interior. So with that, Dreyer Hopkins is here to answer any specific questions and give you a few more details on the CS.
Mr. Hopkins, please, and actually, Senator Thomas, I think you need to state your name for the record.
Oh, start with that. Senator.
Just so the record's complete, I want to make sure
that's right.
Good statements are forever attributed to you.
Okay, great. I was really fascinated with the two microphones. Senator Joe Thomas, District D, Fairbanks. Maybe B, we're not sure which district yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greyer Hopkins. I'm staff to Senator Joe Thomas. You have version D in front of you of Senate Bill 153, and it looks substantially different than what we had before in Senate in version I, but there's only one substantive change to the bill. The rest is simply formatting and organization within statute, and I'll run down how those changes have worked for the committee. The major substantive change, first of all, version D of Senate Bill 153 mirrors House Bill 289, which is the House companion version for the bill and just passed out of House Resources Committee. So we adopted their identical language to make sure we're all on the same page. And the one substantive change that came out of that committee was the lowering of the floor for the size of the liquid natural gas storage facility that can apply for a tax credit. And that committee, Representative Feige, wanted to make smaller utilities along the rail belt and areas that might get access to natural gas and liquid natural gas in the future, wanted to allow those smaller utilities to be able to access this credit. So that floor was dropped from 1 million gallons to 25,000 gallons. It's a substantial drop, but it opens up the opportunities to small utilities that are not connected to the grid so that they can have backup power or lower their own costs, such as Alaska Power and Telephone or the Copper Valley Electric Association, just to name a few examples. I'm sure there's many others around the state that could get access to it. That floor brings it to about 2.1 million cubic feet of gas that would be able to be storable and still qualify for the tax credit, but mostly for the 50% of the construction cost, not the $15 million limit that would be met up there. That is the one substantive change to the bill. The major other change is that the original version I, that we had before the committee, the previous hearing, addressed the storage credits within current existing statute. That was modeled after House Bill 280 from the 2010 legislature, sponsored by Representative Hawker and I believe the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And Senator Thomas met with a number of members from both houses and both bodies, and they were interested in seeing some changes where because of the differences between storing liquid natural gas, the volumes, the methods that it needs that are used to store that gas, wanted to see it in a different section in statute entirely. So you can go sort of section by section and match them up, but it doesn't work perfectly, so I'll give an overview of the changes. Section 1 of version D addresses the lease exemption specifically, which is taken identically from version I, which was section 2 in version I, and put in its own section, section 1 in version D. It's, again, identical. If there are any questions specifically how the lease would work, because it's slightly different than the way the lease exemption was going in for CINGSA, the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Association, that exemption is slightly different. I'd like to refer those questions on the lease exemption to Gene Terrio, former Senator Gene Terrio of GVEA, who should be on the phone. But that is the first change to the bill. After that, it moves on to work on what the definition of a liquid or natural gas storage facility is, and adds in there specifically liquid natural gas or a above-ground containment structure, because you store liquid natural gas in a thermos essentially above ground. And that is very similar to version I, except for the addition of the above-ground storage language. From there, in Section 3 of version D, it creates the its own section and statute for the tax exemption. 4320047 follows directly from 4320046, and just goes section by section down, matches the previous language except for the changes in how the credits are applied for that $15 million cap and the 50% of construction costs. And it changes wherever it says in statute from storage of natural gas, it says storage of liquefied natural gas, minor changes. And you can see at the bottom of page 3, there's the 25,000 gallon floor that has been changed. From there on, it, as I said, it mirrors exactly the goals of what version I intended to do, but in slightly different formatting, and continues on for a number of pages. It has some definitions there for liquid natural gas storage facility. I would like to also direct the committee's attention to page 4, line 5 through 9, which was a point of concern for a number of members, making sure that the any savings that are passed on to the utility through this would be regulated and guaranteed to be passed on through the customers through regulation of the RCA, by the RCA of those. It's very important because we don't want to be passing along state money to utilities that then are not seen by the ratepayers, because the entire goal of this bill is to, of course, lower the cost for any natural gas users in Alaska, making sure the Alaskans have access to those same savings. Mr. Chairman, I believe that's generally how the CS change works. As I said, Gene Terrio, former Senator Gene Terrio from GVEA, is online to answer any specific questions about the project that I don't know. I believe Mr. Lenny Dees from the Department of Revenue is also online if there are specific questions on that.
Any further questions by the Senator or his staff? Seeing none, I will remove my objection to bringing version D of Senate Bill 153 before the committee, so it is now officially before the committee. Mr. Lenny Dees and Robin Wilson from the Department of Revenue are available. Are there any questions of them? Seeing none, we do have Gene Terrio from Golden Valley Electric. Are you available?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm online.
All right, and I guess just getting right to the point, do you, on behalf of Golden Valley, support the changes in the bill in the / D version?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have worked closely with the sponsor staff in the Senate and the House and appreciate their close collaboration. We believe the structure that is before you today addresses the concerns that the prime sponsors heard from some legislators in trying to insert the liquefied natural gas storage into the existing statute that was put into place in 2010 that was specifically designed to apply to gaseous methane or storage of natural gas in a gaseous form. As Mr. Hopkins indicated, we have adopted or duplicated sections of the statute and just made them now applicable to liquid storage. And we also understood the concern of Representative Feige that if we make the product available specifically in interior Alaska, but other places in the state, whether small communities would be able to get some state assistance to receive the resource and actually put it to good use in their smaller communities. We are trying very much to serve the largest volume possible under the concept of the larger the volume, the lower the per unit price. So as we bring the product into interior Alaska, if there are utilities are specifically what we have in mind, or some industrial use up and down the highway system that could avail themselves of putting in smaller storage, they would then be sort of the industrial base in a smaller community, like Mr. Hopkins mentioned, Alaska Power and Telephone and Tok that produces the electric power. That would be the local industrial base there, and then perhaps others in the community would figure out a way then to avail themselves of the resource for space heat or other energy uses. So we did not have any problem with dropping the volume threshold down to the 25,000 gallons.
Thank you very much. Any additional questions? Of no, seeing none, we thank you very much, Senator. Very much appreciate your comments. Just as a clarification, so that it's better understood on the record, when one thinks of $4 a gallon for heating oil, if you got 1,000 gallons and you had to fill that in your tank to get the same number of BTUs using gas, under current cost structure, it's about $1,400. So, you know, those, if South Central had to pay the equivalent of $4 a gallon for gas, their bill would increase from about $1,400 a year to $4,000 a year. And then I think people would understand that that's budget-busting type of numbers when you're talking, you know, $2,500, $2,600 just for that relative scale. And certainly when you add on top of that doubling the electric price per month as well, to have an understanding of the crisis that that puts Interior Alaska in on a relative scale. Any further questions, comments, observations? As I indicated earlier, we are just now getting this before us, and we you know, would provide notice to people so that they can comment about something. And so we hope to get this heard promptly and moved out of resources. Is there any other questions or any other issue before the committee? Senate resources for Monday, March 5th is adjourned.